What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650, your home of the Canucks. I'm Jamie Dodd, my co-host. He's Thomas Drance, who also covers the team for The Athletic. We're on location today, but always broadcasting live from the mobile Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And this hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. You need forklifts that perform under pressure and pallet racking that maximizes your space. Visit them online at racksteel.com. And today, as mentioned, on location here at the 26th annual Canucks Alumni Golf Classic at University Golf Club out at UBC. Always a pleasure to be here. They are just about to tee off. We are perfectly positioned at the 10th tee to witness this shotgun start here. So maybe we'll get a little golf commentary on the drives of some of the alumni that come through here throughout the day. This year's version of the tournament in support of the Boys and Girls Club of South Coast BC and the Canucks Alumni Scholarship Program. And if you're not golfing, you can still contribute. You can still make a difference. You can go to VancouverCanucksAlumni.org and click on the Donate Now button. So we'll see if we can track some people down as they come through here, some alumni, maybe Canucks personnel or two here at the tournament. But we also have Harmon Dial going to join us at 12:30, and lots to get into. Drance, what's going on, man?
Well, not much. I forgot that we were on site today. I'm not going to lie. So my wife,
weren't up to date on a scheduling quirk of Canucks talk?
Shocker. And so I didn't lobby my wife to work from home today so that I could use our one vehicle. So I asked you if you would drive me here, and of course,
no, that's
not
accurate.
Silence.
That's not accurate.
Melina's right here. Lena can confirm. Lena was like bending over backwards to try and accommodate me.
Oh, you know what?
You didn't respond.
I actually do now. I look back and now see that you did say explicitly, "Any chance I can catch a ride, Jamie?" I thought you just put it out to the group generally.
No. No, and then as you'll see, the next 10 messages are Lena doing everything she possibly could to try and accommodate me while you are unresponsive, at which point I'm like, don't worry about it, no stress, which you took to mean leaving
you. You're like, don't even worry about it, I'll Uber. And I'm like, great, he's got it figured out. He got it sorted out.
Yeah, he got it sorted out. He'll spend money as opposed to me responding to this threat.
Drance has two jobs, he can afford it. To be fair,
you're not wrong, but I still would have appreciated it.
What's the point of having two jobs if you can't spring for an Uber some of it? To be fair,
what's the point of having a co-host?
You sent the "any chance I can catch a ride" at 8:30 a.m., which is like peak hustling the kids out the door time.
Fair enough.
And by the time I came back and like reacquainted myself with what was going on in the chat, you were like, "Oh, no stress, I'll Uber. Don't even worry about it."
Got it.
I was like, awesome.
So what
check.
I should have done was followed up. I should have been a little bit ruder and been like, "Jamie, you gonna respond here?"
Yes.
And then you would have been like, "Yeah, no problem."
That's correct.
And I would have been fine.
I would have begrudgingly given you a ride.
Hey, all good, man. Sometimes,
you will need a ride home.
I will give you a ride home.
I'm just saying.
If this is you, it's like, I'm like Major League Baseball. Right? You like express written.
I'm just saying the three of us, right? If we were a forward line, very clear that Lena would be the driver.
Sure. Fair enough. And we are the passengers here. Absolutely.
No question.
We're the finishers. All right. As I mentioned, we do have a lot to get into today. Now, the Stanley Cup Finals rematch is official, and I do want to talk about that. But, I mean, we are Canucks talk, so I do want to take the luxury of having Canucks, directly Canucks-related hockey, to talk about here on June 2nd. And I'm, of course, talking about the Abbotsford Canucks, who are two wins away from playing for the Calder Cup. They're up 2-0 in their series against the Texas Stars. The series shifts for three games in Texas now, which starts with Game 3 tonight. At 5 o'clock, you can hear Brandon Assel's call on 650. So, tremendous start to the series for Abbotsford to be up 2-0, a golden opportunity to advance to the Calder Cup final, and Artur Shelov really continues to be the story of this run. Not that there haven't been other good performances, but you're always looking from the Vancouver Canucks perspective of, okay, who's changing the narrative, who's changing what we think of them, who's raising expectations in a run like this, and really that guy number one is Artur Shelov. He earns another shutout, his fifth already of the Calder Cup playoffs in a 1-0 win in Game 2. And I think it's fair to say, Drance, that both of us, like our general perspectives on sports and hockey, there's always a temptation to use the small sample size brush off, right? Like, small sample size, don't get too excited about it. But eventually, it become this performance from Archer Shelovs. Like, if you'd asked me 2 weeks ago, I probably would have gone to the small sample size card. Eventually, it becomes something that you at least have to consider, that you can't just wave away with the small sample size thing. And when I say it's something you have to consider, well, I don't know if that means all of a sudden you have to move heaven and earth to make sure you don't lose Archer Shelovs off waivers. I know Kevin Woodley was on with Halford and Brough this morning saying, I don't even know if he would get claimed on waivers in training camp next year or in preseason next year. So I don't know exactly what decision you have to land on, but it has certainly made what, again, a month, 6 weeks ago, felt like a relatively straightforward decision with low stakes on how you handle Shelovs to something that feels more significant and more complicated than that for the Canucks.
Yeah, and I think where we should land is whether or not, like, anyone telling you this guy will get or won't get claimed off of waivers is looking at it the wrong way. It's always going to be a percentage, you know, and it's never going to be 100%. You might get to 99. You might get to 99.9%, but you're never getting to 100%. Timing, roster size, cap considerations, if a team has another significant trade in the hopper and wants to keep some space available, like, these are extremely complicated decisions when you're talking about putting in a claim or not. What I think is fair to say is, as a result of this run in the Calder Cup playoffs, Archer Shelovs has reminded the hockey world of something that they kind of already knew, which is that while his American League performance and NHL performance, large sample, is pretty mid repeatedly in the biggest games and on huge stages at a very young age, Archer Shelovs comes up big. And he's done it time and time again. And look, I think there's an element to which being just a guy that can be trusted to not get the yips, being a guy who can be trusted to sort of keep their head about them, even as the stage gets big and the lights get bright and the stakes get daunting. I mean, there's huge value in that for NHL teams. Throw in the fact that Shelovs is 24, extremely athletic, has the size template. You know, at some point, too, Canucks goalie scout Ian Clark could land again with another team. Yep. And if that were to happen, you'd imagine that, like, X team hires Ian Clark. Well, guess what? That team's almost certainly going to claim Archer Shelovs should sort of things unfold. In that case, I might get to 100%.
If Ian
I might
Clark
have to
goes
make
somewhere.
An exception.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So I'm just saying, like, there's all sorts of contingent scenarios here that could shape Canucks decision making, and I think where you have to proceed, what you have to start with, is the Demko thing. Like, you don't start at Archer Shelovs and then work your way up to Thatcher Demko. You start at Thatcher Demko. You start at the goaltender that's in this organization who has been a Vezina nominee before and has spent much of the last 10 years being considered one of the top prospects in hockey and then one of the best college goaltenders in hockey and then one of the best American League goaltenders in hockey and then one of the best National Hockey League goaltenders. And look, he had a nightmare season and he's extension eligible on July 1. And the Canucks, I think, are open to extending him, but I think they have to share the risk. I think it's going to be a team-friendly deal in the event that it gets done. And if it can't get done, then I think both Demko and the Canucks have a pretty difficult situation to navigate, a set of decisions to make in terms of what makes the most sense for him in a contract year, given the injury risk that presumably still exists, given the unprecedented knee tear that he sustained and the two follow-up injuries that he dealt with while working his way back into form, not to mention the fact that there was a performance impact. Even outside of the two additional extended absences, a back injury, a groin injury, you know, we're talking about a goaltender who was what, an 880 goaltender? I mean, it wasn't vintage Thatcher Demko. We saw fits and starts, flashes of the completely imperious, dominant, athletic, technically brilliant goaltender that Thatcher Demko is when he's 100%, but he wasn't 100% this past year. And I don't think you take it to the bank or should take it to the bank that he can be 100% this upcoming year, given, you know, the trajectory and the fact that we've seen this a million times over across the last three decades of hockey where, you know, sometimes you sustain enough injuries and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It has its own momentum. Hurt guys stay hurt.
Yep.
I hope that that's not where Thatcher Demko is. I guarantee you, given his maniacal work rate, how thoughtful and intelligent he is about the way he prepares both his body and his game, that he's doing everything possible to avoid getting on that track. But, you know, certainly it's something you have to acknowledge. You have to price into any discussion of this. So, for me, Demko's like the ultimate risk-reward sort of, you know, high ceiling, low floor bet that the Canucks have to decide how they're going to handle. And I think once you've decided that, and that rests on A, how extension talks go, B, what his market value might be, C, what you think you can do with the additional, you know, $4.25 million in cap space, which is basically the difference between his cap hit
and
Artur Shelov's. And D, like what your medical people and human performance people say about sort of where Demko's overall game is at, not to mention your assessment of Artur Shelov's ability to grow his game and address the deficiencies that caused him to be unplayable, even in a backup role at the NHL level this season. But you don't start, I don't think, as like a, has Shelov's done enough to change how you approach things with Demko? For me, the Demko, like stick handling the Demko situation and your assessment of Demko is so complex and so high leverage for this hockey team that it has to start there and then flow backwards, work its way down to sort of shaping a decision on what to do with Artur Shelov's. And maybe Shelov's just ends up being, you know, maybe it's a piece of a deal with a team that has some interest in a goaltender. Maybe you just re-roll it and get a third or fourth round pick, fifth round pick for a promising young goaltender. Maybe that's how this plays out. But I do think either you're, like, I do think there's an element to which it would be irresponsible for the Canucks to go into training camp with all three on the roster. I think you either want to manage your risk on Demko via trade at some point this summer or manage the waiver risk on Shelov's and get something to allow another team to hold that flyer in training camp.
Yeah, I think the point about it, it doesn't actually necessarily directly impact the Demko decision is an important one because I think it affects what you do after you make the Demko decision more than anything. Because, I mean, we were talking about can you extend Demko? Should you explore a trade thing? That was a talking point before Artur Shelov's went on this run in the AHL, right? So in some ways, that's an yes, they're all goalies, and it's obviously all going to have a domino effect on each other. But that was a conversation independent of Artur Shelov. So you do kind of have to deal with that one first. And then I guess the question, let's say they did decide to move on from Thatcher Demko, which is a massive decision. The question then, you start to get into your evaluation of Artur Shelov's then. And, okay, are we really willing to go into the season with a Kevin Lankinen and Artur Shelov's tandem, given the NHL-level performance we saw from Artur Shelov's just last year, right? Whereas you said, it was unplayable. I mean, he could barely get in the crease, and we saw what it looked like, you know, from being the opening night starter to not that long after. It was Kevin Lankinen's to run with. And that, to me, is that's the big question. It's just how much internally has this changed their evaluation of what Artur Shelov's can be, their willingness to roll the dice and see. Because I think more than anything, we're talking about here now, go from a guy who probably wasn't in their plans, and hey, you lose him on waivers, whatever, no big deal, to somebody that you probably at least want to get another look at in your organization. You know what I mean? You want to see, okay, is this the start of something significant, something that changes the calculus for him at the NHL level? I don't, like, the three goalie thing doesn't make any sense to me, especially when you consider what the other work they have to do on the roster.
No. It's impractical. You can't really do it.
Yeah.
Until the NHL creates a third goalie roster spot, like a taxi squad that applies solely to goaltenders, I don't really think you can roster three goaltenders over the long haul.
No. I don't think it makes any sense.
By the way, they should do that. Like, they have it in the playoffs.
Yeah.
It would prevent e-bugs from entering games. And I know everyone loves the Disney movie of the week element of the Zamboni driver who beat the Maple Leafs. Like, I get it.
That was awesome.
It was so sick. And especially that it happened to the Leafs.
It was so great.
Or the accountant. Remember the accountant in Chicago? Yep. That was also sick. Like, it is cool, but you know who absolutely hates it? NHL goaltenders.
Sure.
They think it just devalues their work. That, like, NHL games should be dependent on the idea of having an NHL level puck stopper in the net come hell or high water, and I find it hard to disagree with them. You know, we do those like anonymous polls, and every year, every goaltender that I've ever talked to about it, like, what's one rule you would change? It's like e-bugs.
Yeah,
it drives them nuts.
Yeah,
and I think that's fair. Like, I think we should listen to that and weight it pretty heavily, in my opinion. So, anyway, I think rostering three goaltenders is completely impractical. I don't think that's something that you can do. So for me, anyway, the Shelov's decision is backseat relative to a Demko decision. But, you know, look, there's an argument to be made. If there's another team that wants to roll the dice on a high upside goaltender and is willing to pay fair value for that. Now, not as a, like, Vezina candidate level Demko, as if the last 16 months didn't happen, but is willing to value him as, like, yeah, I mean, the best bet and a better bet than any of these unrestricted free agents. And, you know, certainly the equivalent value of a late first or an early second type value. I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that, you know, Shelov's has ceiling in his game, not as much as Thatcher Demko, but there is ceiling there. And the Canucks would also suddenly have $18 million in cap space to play with, which makes the prospect of landing three different forwards somewhat more straightforward. I mean, I can see that argument, but I think the upside case that Demko presents is also significant enough that, you know, if you wanted to go into the season and say, hey, one thing we know is between Lankinen and Demko, we're going to have some of the best goaltending in the Western Conference. And in fact, that's key to our logic that this team can, you know, upset the apple cart in the Pacific and skate with Vegas and Edmonton in the toughest games of the year. You know, it seems thin to me, but at least it's a story you could tell yourself.
I think the allure of that is going to be, is ultimately going to override the other concerns here, right? Because we know how many flaws in a team exceptional goaltending can paper over. And I think considering the stakes of this season, both from a whole organizational perspective, but also probably like job security for the front office, I think is probably very much a big deal going into this season. I think it's going to be tough to walk away from a Demko Lankinen tandem to a Lankinen Shelov's tandem. Now, I will say you can move Demko. There's other goalies you can sign, right? So you don't have to put all of your eggs in the Lankinen Shelov's basket necessarily. There's other things you can do, but the upside that you can see with a Demko Lankinen tandem is pretty significant, and I think that's going to be too tempting ultimately for the front office to go in a different route. Could that change if Demko's contract demands are, you know, completely out of, like, if they're not close when they get to talk contract? Yeah, it absolutely could, but I just know how unwilling so many hockey organizations are to roll the dice on goaltending. And I think you can make a strong argument that they should be more willing to, but I think typically they're not.
Well, except that you're rolling the dice either way. That would be the one mitigating factor here. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course there is a, you know, an element too to which when a player wants to be extended and given what's asked of an NHL goaltender, what they have to sacrifice, the, you know, whether you're playing hurt, because you're playing hurt at some point in the season, especially when you're stopping 100-mile-per-hour slap shots, multiple of them a night at the NHL level. No, you know, like, if you're in a contract year and you couldn't come to terms with the team on an extension and you didn't see eye to eye, like, that impacts availability too.
Well, you know, like, I'm of the position that it's either extension or trade.
I think so.
I have no interest in pending UFA Thatcher Demko.
No.
That makes no sense.
That to me is too high. That would far exceed my risk tolerance all around, right? Like, it's so easy to draw a straight line between that and, oh, the deadline expired and there wasn't enough interest given that, you know,
goalies are never get that great offers and he's so valuable to us and, hey, we're in ninth. We're going to play him a lot down the stretch. It's like, man.
I mean, increasingly, as and I said this a couple weeks ago, but increasingly my view is just that there is no world in which I think this organization should ever go into the deadline with a key unresolved issue. Like, I honestly think new rule, this organization should be proactively handling almost every expiring player situation because across 15 years and three distinct eras of management groups, like whether we ran out of time or we couldn't get fair value for the guy, deadlines are clearly thorny for this organization.
I'm trying to think of like a lie we all tell ourselves about like things we need to get done in our personal lives.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like for me, it's always like, oh, I'll do this just before I go to bed, right? And it's like, I never do it before I go to bed.
No.
It's like, if I don't do it then, I'm not going to do it.
Oh,
it's
no.
like the
Sorry.
Canucks version is, we'll figure it out at the deadline.
You
it's like,
what?
No, you won't. You're not going to do that.
You know what mine is putting off a key bit of work and then being like, but I'll wake up early. And
yes, yes.
You know what
exactly.
I will never wake up early.
Never. The alarm
it.
Goes off. You're like, no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, no chance. Because I'll live with the consequences.
That's exactly it. If that's in the Canucks, that's what they tell themselves. They're like, well, we'll figure it out the deadline. We got the deadline still. It's like, no, you don't. It does not exist for you, for all intents and purposes.
100% does not exist. So, look, the overall situation's interesting. I think the truth is that while we've thought critically and spoken critically about it for the last, 20 minutes here, I think the starting point is that you've got a super high-end netminder who, there's some interesting sort of political maneuvering that might need to happen in terms of massaging whether he gets an extension or not. But if healthy, he's one of the best puck stoppers on the planet. You've got a player in Lankanen who crushed it and is a super high floor sort of 1A type goaltender and has proven that now. And you've got Artur Shelovs, who's still 24 and while he's been wildly inconsistent and has some real flaws in his game, specifically in terms of stopping pucks through layered traffic, has repeatedly demonstrated big game bona fides in addition to being super athletic, super composed, and still extremely promising. That's a good starting point. You know, like, it's complicated. There are various factors and limitations that the club will have to jump through or manage, but you know, at least you're starting from a baseline, unlike when we talk about the Canucks forward group.
Sure.
Where, like, the talent level in aggregate within the organization is pretty high, and surely you've got enough ingredients to make the stew. It's just about carving out exactly what that recipe looks
like. Yeah, you're talking more about, like, which interesting assets you want to bet on and ride with, rather than trying to acquire the interesting pieces, which is 100%. Much more difficult to do. And I do think this conversation is amplified because of the accurate perception that the Canucks need to have a monster offseason, right? So, like, there's a lot of kind of middle of the ground or middle of the road outcomes probably here, but naturally our heads all turn to, well, how can they make the most of this? How can they really hit a home run out of even this situation? And that's where it starts to get interesting. Just a couple of texts here before we go to break. We'll get to Harmon on the other side. Mark in White Rock says, guys, Shelovs could earn shutouts in every game remaining this year, and still no Canucks fan would have any confidence in him being a legit NHL option next year. So they must trade him while he has any value. The confidence thing, that's my biggest question, is the internal confidence.
Right.
Like, how scarred were they by the Artur Shelov experience in the NHL level last year? And are they willing to go into this season with it? That's the number one question to me.
I mean, very. But, you know, that cuts both ways, right? On the one hand, how confident are you in any game that Shelov plays that he's going to, like, stop X point shot?
Yeah.
But how confident are you in any game that Thatcher Demko plays that he's going to finish the game?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, there's – and so, you know, confident – and then the other fact of the matter is that while we feel confident that Kevin Lankanen can play 45 to 55 games and provide above-average netminding, you know, it's not like the season that he just had is something he's done year after year after year throughout his career either. Right? So even that sense of confidence that we wouldn't bring up, it's worth gut-checking it because when we're talking about the most volatile position in hockey, you know, where performance vacillates wildly year over year, the confidence you feel might be false.
Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. We are live on location at the Canucks Alumni Golf Tournament here at University Golf Club. It's the Charity Classic in support of the Boys and Girls Club of South Coast BC and the Canucks Alumni Scholarship Program. Harmon Dial joins us next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.
Sportsnet 650, Vancouver.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz broadcasting live from the Mobile Kintec studio here live from the Vancouver Canucks Alumni Charity Classic at University Golf Club at UBC. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lover text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com.
The scene here is we are getting heckled by Kirk McLean in the coolest hat.
Yes.
The coolest hat I've seen is incredible. Great scenes at the
Absolutely. As I said, we're right at the turn. We're at the 10th, and there's a bit of a traffic jam to start things off. So
significant traffic
tensions
jam.
Tension's running high here at the 10th tee at University Golf Club. But it's all in good fun. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel offers industry-leading heli forklifts and engineered racking solutions. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Now joining us from The Athletic, covering the Canucks and the NHL, he is our guy, Harmon Dial. Harm, how's it going, man?
I mean, it was already a great day, but to also start the week with a couple of classic Drantz cackles, I mean, it just brightens the day up further, you know?
Oh, my goodness.
What could be better than that? I'm sure just what you were waiting for to really get your week started, Harm. We had a big conversation about Artur Shelov's and the decision facing the Canucks in net. And it's not as simple as, you know, do you want Shelov's or do you want Demko? And in some ways, the Demko conversation is kind of independent of what they want to do with Artur Shelov's. But just from your perspective, how much differently should we look at Shelov's as a result of these of what he's doing in the Calder Cup playoffs? Or should it not change our opinion of his prospects and his future too much?
Well, it's just a reminder that goaltenders are so volatile and swing up and down all the time. And to be totally honest with you, even before he went on this playoff run, the idea of Shelov's potentially figuring it out next season and randomly becoming an NHL caliber goaltender, that was still a possibility just because young goalies especially can always track up and down. And him going on this postseason heater, it's a reminder that, yeah, there is that potential. Now, it's not a guarantee, and that's what you really have to be careful with if you're the Canucks. It would maybe be a different conversation if he, for a full season in the AHL plus the playoffs, had been playing at this kind of dominant elite level. But his results during the regular season, even at the American League level, were decent, but they weren't spectacular. And so he's a goaltender that I look at and go, I like him as a number three guy. In most organizations these days, you need a third goaltender that you feel somewhat confident in as far as being able to platoon and play NHL games. So that's kind of how I view him. It hasn't changed my thought process as far as believing he's necessarily ready to be a full-time backup next season. I like him in the number three spot, and we'll just kind of see how things progress in terms of his development. I'm firmly in the camp. Goaltenders are largely voodoo, and so he's we know he's got potential, right? The explosive lateral movement, the raw tools are there, but we also saw during the NHL this season that he has some tracking issues that he needs to work through. And again, I don't think big picture changes a lot with the Canucks goaltending plans.
Do you think in any way that the Canucks should be mindful of managing their risk on Shelov's becoming or requiring waivers beginning, you know, this fall? Should he be a player where if they have an opportunity to cash in or even just re-roll on his sort of draft cost from 2019 here this summer, they should be mindful of that versus, you know, the sort of flexibility of entering camp with three guys that you're keenly interested in? And how would Demko's sort of health, right, and the season that he endured over the course of the past year sort of factor into your thinking about this topic?
Yeah, this is where management's going to have to make a really interesting decision as far as trying to weigh the risk of him actually getting claimed off waivers. Because if you don't think the risk is high, then I would lean towards keeping him because there is still that upside and he at least has some level of NHL experience. But we also know that this management group last offseason, for example, sort of did a similar risk assessment with Vasily Podkolzin, and who would have required waivers, and they kind of determined that he probably would get claimed and decided to cash in on that asset. I wonder if it's a little bit different for goaltenders just because it can sometimes be harder to, you know, like there are only two NHL, you know, goalie spots on a roster to full-time commit to a guy as impressive as Shelov has been during, you know, this playoff run. Again, the whole sample of work this season, it doesn't give you a full, you know, confidence level or guarantee that he is an NHL caliber goaltender. And so you also see time and time again in waivers sometimes that high pedigree sort of goaltenders at the AHL level, like I think of, you know, some of Hershey's goaltenders, for example, you would look at them and go elite AHL numbers, and you would think, oh, maybe a team wants to take a flyer on one of those guys. But for the reasons I mentioned in terms of the risk of committing a full-time NHL roster spot to that goaltender, those goalies sometimes pass through waivers unclaimed. So I lean towards thinking, even with this playoff run, that he might not get claimed off waivers. And so I would perhaps lean towards sort of keeping him and wanting to retain Shelovs in that number three goaltender spot. But this is where it's at least worth thinking about what is his value on the trade market. And how do you weigh that against the probability of him getting claimed off waivers?
So, Harmon, as we've gone through, you know, all our off-season preview content and built lists of UFAs and trade targets and tiered them and on, right? I was thinking about it last night, and I think I've just decided that I'm going to throw my weight in on if Marco Rossi is really available and the acquisition cost is reasonable at all, that's a gift, the sort of opportunity that the Canucks can't afford to miss, even if it would leave them with a relatively small sort of core group across the board, right? I mean, Hughes, Rossi, Pettersson, Garland as sort of four of your five best players. Throw in Filip Hronek even, who's, you know, if he's over 6 foot, it's by, you know, a skate blade. You know, despite that, and despite the fact that it's clearly suboptimal, I still think this team's need for center depth and Rossi's overall profile is one of those, like, can't-miss opportunities here if he does indeed shake loose from the Wild. What's your reaction to this?
Yeah, it's a tough spot for the Canucks to be in because I don't love Marco Rossi. I think he's a good player, but not just for the size reasons, but even from, like, the fit he's had in Minnesota and how it could potentially translate to Vancouver. Like, I see question marks just in the sense that, you know, this past season, for example, he had one of Kaprizov or Boldy stapled to his wing for basically the entire season, and the Canucks don't have that kind of dynamic elite playmaking winger for him to play with. And when you look at the way Rossi produces, it's as a sort of net front scorer predominantly. He's not necessarily a dynamic, speedy, transitioning the puck up the ice and driving a line offensively by himself type of a player. And so while I love the 60 points he put up this past season, Is he still a 60-point player without Kaprizov or Boldy, especially when, you know, both his individual and on-ice shooting percentages were a little high? I'm not saying it screams regression candidate by any means, especially because he does generate so many looks from in tight. But I don't know if there's a lot of upside beyond what he's already shown. And when you combine that with the size factor, I don't love the fit. I think it's a suboptimal one, but I also look around at the center market and it's so scarce, it's so bare that the lack of alternative options almost forces you to push Rossi up your list, because I mean, how many other in their 20s prime years like bona fide top six centermen are realistically going
None
to be available?
And never. None and never. You know, yeah, like, the next best realistic candidate is Pavel Zacha, right? Who is, I think, materially lower ceiling and older, although cost-controlled. I mean, I still like Zacha. and then we are immediately into your Eric Halla tier, you know, or your like Christian Dvorak in unrestricted free agency tier or what have you, right? And it's it gets grim pretty fast, Harmon.
Yeah, one guy that I would sort of lump into the Rossi conversation as guy that's not a perfect fit, but I would be willing to potentially roll the dice on him is Trevor Zegras.
But he wins 40% of draws, man. Like, he is legit not playable at center, I don't think.
I mean, he did it his first 2 years in Anaheim, though. And I get the faceoffs. Even if he's a winger, though, like, I just think this team needs a player that you look at and go, this guy could turn into a star.
Yeah.
And I think Zegras is higher ceiling because you look at his first two seasons in Anaheim, 61 points, 65 points. And the key to me is he did it as the driver of his own line. He didn't necessarily have high-end top six wingers to play with. And when I look at his ridiculous...
Sonny Milano erasure.
it's true, though. Like, his creativity, just how elite his playmaking vision is. And I know he, over the last couple of seasons, has battled injuries and his offensive numbers have sort of gone down. But I also look at Greg Cronin in Anaheim and think about how many of Anaheim's offensive players stole this year. I mean, Carlson, McTavish, Gauthier was okay in his rookie season. But, like, all of these young offensive guys stalled in Anaheim this year. And when I look at Zegras' combination of his early career production, the fact that he did it as the primary driver, and the fact that I'm really low on Greg Cronin, and think that Zegras escaping that type of environment could allow him to flourish and get back to being a 65-ish point centerman. I really like that. Even though, admittedly, the faceoffs are a massive concern. One thing I will say is I know that there have been sort of question marks around his defensive game as well. He has some work to do, but there have been points of like the 2023-24 season where I sort of was actually watching other guys on Anaheim, and I noticed that Zegras was better positionally, more on the right side of the puck, wasn't cheating for offense as much. I saw tangible improvement in that capacity. So I'm also not as low on his defensive game as maybe some others are.
Yeah, and I think the other thing with Zegras, and I've been kind of beating this drum for a while, Harm, I mean, one, the offensive upside, but also, you know, there's an element where he is under team control because he's going to be an RFA after next year, but you don't have to lock in, right? So he's under control, but you're not adopting a massive term contract here. He's making 5.75 for next year, and then he's an RFA. And you can look at that as a negative, right? Because, okay, you'd have to make a decision, and that's a high number to be starting with if he doesn't clean up some of the things you're hoping he cleans up and really bounces back. But I also look at the Canucks as, you know, a team potentially going into a transitional phase, depending on what happens with Quinn Hughes. I think there's something to be said for kind of taking a flyer on, okay, let's get this guy with super high upside in for 1 year. Then we'll have an ability to make the decision. And if it doesn't work out, there are ways to get out of it. If it does work out, we might have a star player on our hands. I just think you add it all up. Acquisition cost, age, contractual situation, and there's a lot of reasons they should be looking at Trevor Zegras.
Yeah, definitely. And there's flexibility, too, where you could also look at it where if you're confident enough that he's truly going to bounce back and you understand that in today's NHL, one of the best ways to build the best roster possible is to have as many surplus value contracts as possible, you could actually look at it the other way and go, coming off of a down year, if we're really confident he's going to bounce back, this could be an opportunity to actually work out an extension, you know, this offseason and get him at a reduced rate before he potentially pops off. And understanding that if it doesn't work out, then let's be honest, the team's probably in a position where Quinn may not stay long-term. And at that point, if Zegras is on, you know, a bit of an expensive contract, it doesn't really matter in the big picture anyway. So that's the other way of looking at it too, is it could also be an opportunity, to buy low, not in terms of the acquisition cost, but also on his next contract. And if he does pop, you get surplus value on his next contract too.
What about the lack of foot speed? I kind of worry with Zegras that, you know, and I've been holding Zegras stock, as Jamie Dodd will attest to, for years, as his stock has plummeted around the league. I'm holding a distressed asset. I'm like yelling, like, hold the line, to myself, basically, when we do this radio show and Trevor Zegras comes up. Realistically, Harmon, like, you know, as much as if I say to you, like, Hronek, Hughes, Garland, Pettersson, Rossi, or Zegras, Pettersson, Hughes, Hronek, Garland, I mean, with what we're seeing work in the playoffs right now, like, does either acquisition actually get them closer to being the sort of team they need to be?
Yeah, I mean, you would still have undeniably question marks about, can you actually have playoff success with a group that is on the smaller side and not very physical? But the reality situation is there's no realistic way to get both, right? If you want a player that has star-level upside and has all those physical attributes, I mean, outside of maybe Alex Tuch if he becomes available this summer, like, those guys just aren't available on the trade market, and everybody's looking for those unicorns. It's just not realistic to check off both boxes. And so what you have to do, in my mind, is you can't find one player that's going to accomplish both goals, but you're going to have to acquire essentially multiple players that can, you know, one addresses maybe the offensive upside aspect, and then with your other acquisitions, you have to fill in and try and address, you know, those size and hard to play against attributes. And so with the Rossi / Zegras, or whether it's, you know, Paterka or Lafreniere or on and on, like, those guys you're hoping can be your, like, high point producer guys that at least get you to the point where you're a team that can make the playoffs and give you, like, raise your sort of offensive potential as a team. And then it's a separate goal and a separate task to try and acquire players that can add some heft to your top line group, that can make your group harder to play against. I don't think there's realistically going to be, like, one player that you can look at and go, well, this guy's going to do it all for you.
Yeah, I think the other part of this conversation from a Canucks perspective is, you know, it would be one thing if they were really flush with assets and cap space relative to the rest of the league, and then you might think, okay, well, if that kind of ideal player does become available, you have the means to really go all in on that player and win the bidding. But, you know, even if that player was out there, they're probably not in position to do that. And I don't want to say they necessarily have to be bargain bin shopping, but it's more, you know, like, sensible middle of the road shopping, like, budget conscious shopping, I think, is what they have to do, which means, as you said, you're not going to be acquiring perfect players given the assets and the cap space that they have to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what makes the fact that they didn't cash in on Besser and Suter at the deadline that much more frustrating, because they don't have that advantage over other teams, both in the asset department and on the cap space front. I mean, I was even just looking through, like, just the Pacific Division, how many teams are sort of gearing up to be aggressive and could be positioned to go big game hunting. Like, the list is kind of endless, right? Vegas at the top. On paper, they may not have a lot of cap space right now, but they have players that they can, like, contracts, like the Nick Watiers, where they could easily move those guys out and then go out and take a run at Mitch Marner in free agency, for example. The Kings have around $21 million in cap space, and Ken Holland was already telling colleague Pierre LeBrun that he expects to be, you know, sort of aggressive, and they have all their picks available. The Ducks. The Ducks have nearly, like, even after they get McTavish and Dostal done, they have around 30-ish million plus an excess of draft picks plus a really deep prospect pool. And Pat Verbeek has said that he expects this, you know, that Ducks team to make the playoffs. So, you know, they're going to be hyper aggressive. Even a team that you wouldn't expect to necessarily be buying, like the Seattle Kraken, I went back and listened to Jason Botterill's end of season availability. And he said that he expects them to be aggressive again. And Ron Francis, even after the Bjorkstrand trade, was talking about, the extra two first-round picks that they got as part of the Bjorkstrand trade, plus they have two extra second-round picks in future years as well, how they're looking at that as potential trade capital when an elite sort of difference maker becomes available. So, like, this is just the Pacific Division. I even talked about teams like Utah that are all sort of hunting for...
Utah's going in, buddy.
Yeah, like, the competition, like, the number of teams that are looking at the assets and cap space they have and their roster needs and going, we want to go all in on adding, like, a star forward when that opportunity presents itself, is sort of endless, and the pool of available players that fits that criteria is pretty shallow. So the Canucks are in a tough spot. They're going to have to sort of find a way to get creative, and it's a really, like, big picture, it's a really, really difficult task for them to position themselves to be a Stanley Cup contender anytime soon. They've got a lot of work to do, and it's going to be incredibly challenging.
No doubt about it, Harm. Great stuff as always, man. We appreciate it. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, guys.
That is Harmon Dial from The Athletic joining us
here. A sober assessment, I would say.
On this show?
No,
never.
At the Canucks Alumni Golf Tournament?
I was gonna say,
is that allowed?
A sober assessment, unlike the participants at the Canucks Alumni Golf Tournament who are enjoying themselves here out at the University Golf Club. As they should. That was Harmon Dial. And, look, every time Zegras specifically, but even with Marco Rossi, when those names come up, the same comments come in, and I understand them about size and the type of player and all of that. I get that. They're not wrong. I can't straight out disagree with the textures and what they're saying, but I also just keep circling back to, well, you kind of got to start somewhere, and you have to bring talent in at some point. And yeah, are you making a hopeful bet at a certain point? Yeah, you are, but what else are you going to do?
I guess the question is, and we can get into this more on the other side, is, like, would you rather bet on traits?
Yes.
You know what I mean? As opposed to skill.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting sort of dichotomy to consider, in part because, if you're thinking about some of the teams that we're going to watch this week contest the Stanley Cup final, like, it's been both. There's been a mix of both in assembling those lineups. So that's a little tease for
there you go.
On the other side.
Look at you go. We'll get into that more, including Drance's latest piece looking at trade targets up at The Athletic right now. That's coming up next year on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
CISL Vancouver is Sportsnet 650, the official home of the Seattle Seahawks.
The Seahawks win the game!
Listen live on HD Radio 96.9 HD3.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd and my co-host Thomas Drance. We are live on location at the Vancouver Canucks Alumni Charity Classic at University Golf Club out here at UBC. This year's tournament in support of the Boys and Girls Club of South Coast BC and the Canucks Alumni Scholarship Program. You can donate even if you're not participating. Go to the Canucks Alumni website. They've got the big Donate Now button that you can click on there. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Of course, we're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. Should also mention, since we chatted with Harmon Dial in the last segment, that guests on Sportsnet 650 call in on the hotline powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on. And I got to say, Kirk McLean stepped up and absolutely striped his tee shot at the 10th tee here.
Shout
out to Kirk McLean.
Yep.
By the way, he was here for a long time. We weren't joking about the traffic jam. Like, that was the opening segment. Wasn't that off the top of the show? He was heckling us?
Yep.
That was an hour ago. He just hit his tee shot. So we'll see if the pace of play improves here as we go on at the University Golf Club. All right, we were talking a little bit about Canucks trade targets with Harm in that last segment. And, of course, lots of text and lots of interest in this. And, I mean, really, I guess after the Elias Pettersson kind of omnipresent conversation, what do they do to address their forward group is the number one topic of the Canucks offseason. So there's a ton of interest, and understandably so, in that subject. And you, tapping into that interest, your finger on the pulse as always, published the piece up at The Athletic today, Canucks trade target tiers for 2025. And there's some familiar names. I mean, we've talked about Marco Rossi. We got into it just there with Harmon a little bit, all the reasons it makes sense, all the reasons that maybe the NHL as a whole is not necessarily high on him. Pavel Zacha, Trevor Zegras, some other names. I do think let's just take a moment on Marco Rossi, even though we have covered him a fair bit on the show, because I think the potentially interesting dynamic here is not only could he be available, but it doesn't even sound, reading some of the tea leaves, like it might be a prohibitive acquisition cost, which I think really makes it an interesting target. It really kind of takes it up a level from a phone call the Canucks should be making to, you know, if this is a relative bargain deal for a 23-year-old who's produced like he has, that could be a very, very interesting proposition for the Canucks.
For sure. And so, sorry, we're talking Robo?
Rossi.
Rossi,
I mean, we can get into Robertson. I mean, that's a fascinating name out there.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, also, if the Stars are prepared to make that level of mistake, you've got to be the team that capitalizes off of it.
And
he was
right shot defenseman, hungry team.
Yeah.
Filip Hronek, like,
oh, well,
matching salaries almost.
Yeah, but presumably they'd be trying to shed salary. So I think you're looking at Volander plus.
All right. Well, that's interesting, too.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, I mean, I think you'd be looking at a cost controlled guy.
Sure.
You know what I mean? They'd be looking at, like, let's have the best defense in the league for Pete DeBoer and then also Mikko Rantanen, which is, you know, pretty cool.
Not
a bad play.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Jason Robertson's a great player. A great player. I mean, a somewhat consistent 40-goal scorer. That's a totally different caliber of guy in my mind. And you know, there's no price you can pay for a player at that stage of his career. Granted, he's sort of about to be paid like a superstar player. But there's almost no price you can pay for a player that good that's bad.
No, that's the guy you cash. That's the guy you cash in your chips for, yeah. Like, without thinking about it.
I do think Harmon brought up a good point, though, which is that this, you know, like the issue with Robertson versus the Rossi tier is, to some extent, you kind of need the Canucks to go after a guy who the team's incentivized to move.
Yes.
You know, and that's sort of why I wonder about the traits-based versus the talent-based thing. Now, I've been thinking about this a lot, and the Florida Panthers in particular, like, what's the lesson of the Florida Panthers? And I feel like, as commonly occurs, right, a lot of the conversation about the Panthers is going to focus on the idea of hard skill, the liberties that they take, sort of the playoff style, right, that they've mastered. And it should. I mean, it's a huge part of why they've been so successful. But I think to focus on that at the expense of the reality that they might have 8 top-line forwards in their lineup right now is to miss the forest for the trees. It is really cool to be a hard-scrabble, tough-as-nails, cynical, battle-tested, hard-skilled team. But what makes the Panthers special is not that they're that. It's that they're that and they have 8 first-line caliber players in their forward group. And, yeah. I think, you know, I've been thinking a lot about, like, E2 Luostarinen. I'm always thinking a lot about E2 Luostarinen,
what a
to be totally, totally honest with you.
That sounds like your opening remarks in therapy. I've been thinking a lot about E2 Luostarinen.
How sure are we that he's not Andrew Ladd? You know? Like, how sure are we that if he got dealt to another team and was installed on the top line, that he wouldn't be what Matthew Nyes is in Toronto or Zach Hyman is in Edmonton or what Andrew Ladd became the moment he wasn't a third liner in Chicago. And it was like, oh, he's a 65-point guy for the Atlanta Thrashers and then the Winnipeg Jets. You know, I'm pretty sure E2 Luostarinen is a top-line caliber forward. And I think Anton Lundell is probably a top-line caliber center. Now, not a high-end top-line caliber center, but in that, like, William Karlsson, Bo Horvat, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, like, low-end top-line caliber center mold, you know, doesn't have as much east-west creativity as a lot of, like, centermen do. A lot of centers are – he almost reminds me a little bit of Bo Horvat in that way, except, you know, he's slighter, and I think he's better defensively. I still think if you were, you know, I think there's a lot of teams that he would be the best center on their team. He's their third best center.
Yeah.
Right? And Sam Bennett, no question, top line caliber player. Matthew Tkachuk, no question. Verhaeghe, no question. Reinhardt, no question. Barkov, elite, elite, elite.
Yeah.
And then Brad Marchand. And it's like, that's eight names. That's eight names. So as much as we're talking about, like, yeah, what the Canucks need is a top two line center, it's like the Canucks need two. You know what I mean? As much as it's like the Canucks need a goal scoring winger, they need multiple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you're going to get to the point of us enjoying a Panthers like run for this Canucks team, if that's even still possible given the current state of their core, like I don't even think we're talking about three forwards. I think we're talking about four and all of them stars, like uniform across the board, top line caliber players. And I mean, it's just absurd how good these teams are.
Yeah. And I think that point about just the volume, one, leads you away from the, you know, letting perfect be the enemy of the good thing, right? Because, again, and I've said this a million times, I don't want to belabor it, but, like, any player that's going to be moved like this almost, by definition, is going to be flawed. That's why they're on the market. Now, maybe Jason Robertson's different if they decide to move him, and that is absolutely the guy you cash in all your chips for, but he's also going to be extremely in demand around the NHL. But by and large, if players are available by trade, there's some flaw. There's something that the other team doesn't like. And I think because the Canucks don't just need that one finishing piece, because they do need just an overall infusion of talent at a volume level, you almost, that, to me, that makes you, it should make you more inclined to go after the players that the rest of the NHL might not be high on, because that's the only way you're going to be able to do the volume. You know what I mean? You're not going to be able to forget one perfect candidate, perfect guy. You're not going to be able to do two or three perfect guys. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to get in four players, they're going to have to be flawed players. So that's part of the allure of a Marco Rossi. It's like, well, the rest of the NHL is down on him. That might allow you to make a bet. Trevor Zegras, same thing. Relatively low acquisition cost. But boom, there's two guys that you've brought in. You know, we can go through the list that you had, but like Mason Marchment, who might be available from Dallas as a cap casualty, under contract for one more year at a reasonable number. I think to me that method of placing a lot of bets on distressed assets is the one that makes the most sense. And they probably won't all work out. That's kind of the nature of making bets on distressed assets. But you just need that talent up and down the lineup. Like, you need to get better everywhere at forward, and that's going to require more than one player, more than two players, and your only way to do that and make it all fit is take some guys that have big question marks. Like, that's it. That's the roadmap. And I think the other thing with Florida is, and I know you've made this point as well, you know, when they made the trade for Sam Bennett, no one was like, oh, that he's going to be a key piece for them. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, they're taking a flyer on Sam Bennett. Yeah, we'll see what he can do. Has never really popped offensively in Calgary. I wonder what Sam Bennett will be for the Florida Panthers. Sam Reinhart, you know, obviously more pedigree there and had more production in Buffalo. But still, I don't think it was necessarily like they're acquiring a 50-goal scorer Selke candidate in Sam Reinhart. There was question marks about it. You have to be willing to stomach some of those question marks. You have to be willing to place those bets and hope that they work out and put those players in a situation to work out. Because if you're waiting for the perfect 26-year-old center with size and skill to come along, like, you're going to be waiting forever. It's not happening. It's just until the Buffalo Sabres turn another one out, that's not happening for you.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a number of candidates this summer, Jamie.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
We're joined here now. You can do the hosting since it's your job. By Matt Cook. Let's go.
Yeah, Matt Cook here for the Vancouver Canucks alumni golf tournament and taking a second to sit down with us tableside. Matt, we appreciate it. How's it going?
Good, man. You?
Good. We got him turned up there and everything later. All right, yeah. All right.
I think I heard myself.
There we go. We can hear you now.
Maybe I am hearing things.
How's the round going so far, Matt?
We're one under. It's tough right now. The wind is kicking up pretty good out here, and I don't think the yardages they're giving you are pretty spot on, so.
You're adjusting on the fly.
That's right.
Well, way to be one under. Congratulations.
Well done.
I mean, that's not sucking. You know?
Absolutely.
So, are you here for the golf tournament? Are you out here coaching at the moment, too? Or what brought you out here? Just to catch up with old pals and support the good causes?
Well, so I came out in November and played in the Canucks Autism Network event, and ever since I've been out, kind of really just felt the vibe here in the city reconnecting, and so I've come out here and done a lot of charity things since then, and then also, you know, I've worked a little bit with TD Bank, doing some stuff with them, and then
very cool.
I recently was voted into the Canucks alumni because I live out of town. I had to be voted in. So
okay.
I was accepted, thank God. I don't know what I would have done if I wasn't.
Do you have to like submit a business case or a resume?
I've never heard of this. What's the did you have to like shake hands and stuff?
No, but someone had to like
vouch for you?
Put me up for
who did it?
Ron, a buddy of mine, Ron Patterson.
Okay.
And then Bob Murray seconded it, and then they had to have a vote. So I've been included in it, which is amazing. It's a great thing. And so because of that, I got to come out and play in the golf tournament.
Well, that's awesome. Congratulations, first of all. I mean, I got to say, like, how many – I don't know how many hundreds of games you played for the Canucks, but it was a lot. That would have been a pretty outrageous exclusion, I think, if you hadn't made it in. I think
I played just over 600 or something for Vancouver.
My goodness.
I was here for 10 years.
That's a lot.
Yeah, I kind of grew up here.
You know, 20 years old to 30 years old,
so – definitely feels like home when I'm around. And Thursday I'm taking part in a Canucks for Autism event at Sky Helicopters.
Matt, since we have you on the show and since we were just talking about the Florida Panthers and their mastery of the dark art of playoff hockey, right? The heavy skill that they play with, some of the accidental on purpose things that they get away with uncalled, the fact that they're just such a wagon. You're a guy who obviously knew where that line was, maybe crossed it a couple times in your career, but provided value to your teams in that sort of manner of the game. What do you think of when you watch this team play in the playoffs?
I mean, the first descriptive word is that they're heavy. Mm-hmm. I mean, from top to bottom, whether it's Tkachuk or Barkov, like, you know, they all play heavy. Mm-hmm. They obviously add Seth Jones on the back end, and it's a 6'5" defenseman that is heavy, right? Yeah. So like they're a heavy team to play against. And the one thing I loved is last year when they were in the playoffs, and you know, Tkachuk talked about, you know, playoff hockey is no different because we play it all year. And that was my mindset. Like when we got to playoff hockey, nothing changed for me. It was the same. Whereas a lot of guys had to add in physicality, and that's taxing. It's really hard to now have to physically engage, shift in and shift out, because you're not conditioned to do that if you don't play that way all season.
That must be mentally taxing for those guys too, right? To adopt that new mindset, whereas you're doing, as you said, it's every game for you. It's just a continuation of what you've been doing.
Yeah, for sure. Like there's obviously a mental strain, because in a moment where you're going to get a puck and you're thinking offensively, now maybe you're thinking who's coming physically, right? But then also you're going in the forecheck where you may cheat to pick off a puck and you think, oh, it's playoffs, I got to be physical. Well, that bump now means that your shift is 44 seconds instead of 52. So it just has an accumulation of effect, especially over the course of, you know, one round, two rounds, three rounds. The deeper it goes, the harder it gets.
I'm also fascinated by the mentality where, you know, you mentioned it's Barkov, right? Like it's their top line center, right? It's Tkachuk, it's their leading scorer, right? Like it's not their bottom six is really heavy. It's throughout their lineup. And honestly, I think you see it with Edmonton too, just the way it looks a little different. It feels a little different, but the way you'll see like Dreisaitl dig pucks in greasy areas of the ice and then use the body to make a physical play protecting it and find a backdoor pass or what have you. Like both of those teams throughout the lineup, like their star guys are playing heavy.
I mean, it's been that way for ages. When your best players do the right things and play the right way, it then becomes unacceptable for everybody else not to, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I can remember, obviously, we got a chance to win the Stanley Cup in 2009 with Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of went on this hiatus where they didn't win another, I think, until 15 and or 16. And when that happened, there was a transition midseason. You know, there was a shift where Sidney backchecks, breaks up a puck. Then there's a shot, and he blocks the shot. It goes again, so they go down and score. And in that moment, I mean, I was retired, so I wasn't playing. And I texted him. I was like, you guys are going to win this year. And he was like, why would you say that? And I was like, because you don't give anybody a choice. Mm-hmm. And it's just – it's noticeable. This playoff, Dreisaitl against Vegas didn't have a goal or a point in two games. And he was like, as long as we win, I don't need to score. And that is such a mature mentality for a superstar. But it really speaks volumes in the four walls of a locker room.
you played, as you mentioned, you won a Stanley Cup with the Pittsburgh Penguins, Sidney Crosby, 21 at that time. And then, I mean, we see him still today doing what he's doing at the international level. I mean, yeah, what
top
was...
Top 10 scorer every year, no big deal.
Yeah, just, I mean, he's been a machine for his whole career and still at his age. What was your, like, what are your lasting memories? Obviously, winning the Stanley Cup is going to stand out, but from kind of being around Sidney Crosby at that age, at that point of his career?
Yeah, I mean, up until I went to Pittsburgh, which was 10 seasons in, you know, I was, for the most part, on a daily basis, I was the first guy on and last guy off the ice. And I went to Pittsburgh, and I was never going to win that battle. he's also, and what I think this word is out more, but he's the most competitive person I've ever been around in my life. And, you know, you get the little mini DeSanti water bottles, and he's sitting in the locker room and he tosses at the garbage can and he misses. And then he looks at me because I'm his stallmate and he's like, "Can you get that?" I was like, "Why?" And he's like, "Well, I can't move until I sink it from here." And he would miss, some days he would miss five or six times. I had to stay there until
the
he made it.
DeSanti caddy.
But from a competitive standpoint, he couldn't move because he hadn't succeeded yet. And that's the drive that he has in everything he does. And so proud to be able to call him a friend and a teammate because, you know, he sets a standard that, you know, it's impossible for others not to follow.
When I think about your early days in Vancouver, coming up and sort of getting your feet wet in the NHL, you had obviously a unique style of play that was noticeable to fans right off the bat. But when I think about that era, I feel like there was a lot of those guys, like whether it was Jarkko Ruutu, Trevor Letowski played pretty hard, and he was a little bit different, a little bit more shifty, but like had that heaviness to his game. I think about guys like Chubarov. Like, I feel like there was a whole bunch of guys who all sort of played with some edge in the bottom six of that sort of like West Coast Express era teams. What do you recall about sort of your first taste of NHL action in Vancouver?
I mean, my first taste was, you know, Mike Keenan was the coach, and I played 3 minutes a game, and
yep.
He just wanted to know if I'd do what was asked of me. You know, like, you know, I was a 100-point guy in Major Junior, and I played 3 minutes a game in the NHL, but, you know, it was the pride of being in the NHL and doing what was ever asked of me in my role. Now, after Mark Crawford came, I actually got to carve out a little bit of a niche, yep, where I could penalty kill and I could contribute and get 30 to 40 points a year without any power play time. And then, you know, there was conversations all the time of like, you know, who was I going to approach to try and get them off their game so that we had a better chance to win. And mm-hmm. Obviously that's a role that I embraced because I kind of read the room and understood that I wasn't going to get power play time or first or second line minutes on a regular basis. And so how can I contribute to my team and make sure I'm giving us the best chance to be successful?
Matt, you said you kind of recently reconnected with the alumni group and actually got into the alumni group, and now you're doing more with it. What makes it special to be a part of this alumni association?
I mean, obviously the guys that are here, you know, the regulars that you see around all the time, and Kirk and Babs and Cliff and, you know, Yerky,
yep,
Trevor. Like, Stan Smeal, Darcy Rota. Like, there's a massive Bob Murray. There's a great group of core guys that are here that are involved all the time. But for me, you know, being able to kind of grow up in Vancouver, you know, from the first 10 years of my career, this place has a real special place in my heart. And so, you know, I kind of been away and doing my family thing, but now, you know, being an empty nester and having more time, coming out here and being involved in this community is super intentional for me because of, you know, I was at Canuck Place all the time,
yeah,
as a player. And, you know, we had our own foundation in the North Shore for years. And so just, you know, being able to give back is special.
And just before we let you go, Matt, because you brought it up about growing up here and your role in the community as a member of the Canucks, and this is a question that comes up all the time now, right, about is the media environment too hot in Vancouver, other Canadian cities? Do guys want to play here? How do you look at it with the perspective of now looking back on your career, having played in Canada, having played in the United States? What was the experience like for you at the time being a member of the Vancouver Canucks?
Well, my first memory of being involved in the community came from Brian Burke. You know, he asked me one day what I was doing. I was probably just going to lounge at the hotel on a day off.
Yeah.
And he sent me with Jamie Husker off to Children's Place, the Children's Hospital, and we spent 3 hours there giving away stuff, meeting with families, spending time, kind of just giving back. And it changed my life because, you know, I got an opportunity to actually see a child that was a Toronto Maple Leafs fan, and his family was there, and 30 minutes of joking around, having fun, finally convincing him to put on a Canuck jersey. The nurse was crying, and I was like, what's going on? And she said 30 minutes ago they got, like, terminal news about their son. Mm-hmm. And for the last 30 minutes, they've been laughing and not thinking about it. And just the power of – it's not even a financial thing. It's just time, you know, going and, you know, being able to use our platform. And so I think this is an unbelievable market, and, you know, I believe that it will return to that, especially with, you know, the way things are going and who's in place. I think Adam's going to do a great job, and, you know, just excited to see the journey that they're on.
Matt, we really appreciate the time, man. This was awesome to catch up with you, and hopefully we'll see you around at more of these events. We'll let you get back to the round.
All right. Thanks, guys.
That is Matt Cook, former Canucks forward, of course, a veteran of more than 1,000 games in the NHL, Stanley Cup champion in 2009 with the Pittsburgh Penguins, kind enough to share some time with us here before he resumes his round at the Vancouver Canucks Alumni Charity Classic. And some really interesting thoughts there from Matt Cook on the Florida Panthers, on his experience in a Canadian market, on Sidney Crosby as well. That story about the water bottle flip or garbage shots from Sidney Crosby not being allowed to move.
Incredible.
It's a fantastic behind the scenes tidbit from Matt Cook, who again just joined us tableside here at University Golf Club. We'll take a quick break here in just a second. We're very pleased to do so, but we were interrupted in our trade target discussion there. So we'll get back into that in the other side. We'll take your text as well. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We got one more segment to go here. Canucks talk on location at UBC, at the University Golf Club for the Vancouver Canucks Alumni Charity Classic. One more segment next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Sportsnet 650, Vancouver.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance live at the University Golf Club at UBC for the Canucks Alumni Charity Classic, this year's tournament in support of the Boys and Girls Club of South Coast BC and the Canucks Alumni Scholarship Program. We're broadcasting live from the Mobile Kintech Studio. And 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. And shout out again to Canucks alumni Matt Cook, who's here playing at the tournament, for giving us some time in the last segment and weighing in on a lot of different things, including his time here in Vancouver. I'm still hung up, though, I got to say, on the glimpse behind the curtain of the admission policy and process for Canucks alumni who don't live in the Lower Mainland, that he had to be voted in. And as I said to him, Matt Cook, he's 20th all time in games played for the Vancouver Canucks. He played 566 games for this organization. So I'm sure it wasn't a close vote, but the fact that he even had to go up for a vote was shocking to me. It's like, yeah, it's a rubber stamp. It's Matt Cook. What are we talking about here?
He was a huge part of those West Coast Express teams. He scored that Game 7 tying goal against the Calgary Flames that, honestly, like, if not for Marty Gelinas, would be one of the most famous goals in Canucks history.
Matt Cook, 566 games, one more than Yannick Hansen, more than Brock Besser, Brendan Morrison, Tony Tanti, Todd Bertuzzi, Kirk McLean, Chris Tanev. So, like, some pretty significant names that that Cook is ahead of on the all-time games played list for the Vancouver Canucks. So shout out to him for making it into the Canucks alumni group. As I said, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And we were having the trade targets conversation. You know, I was making the point about going after some of the more distressed type of assets, some of the volume, so you can do the volume of names that you need to get in to address the talent deficit at forward for the Vancouver Canucks. I did want to touch on some of the names you included on your piece at The Athletic that maybe we haven't talked about as much here. Not that we haven't brought them up at all, but, you know, the Marco Rossis, J.J. Paterka, Trevor Zegras, Pavel Zacha, we've covered that ground to a pretty significant degree. One name that's interesting to me, and you have him in the, hey, we like him if you need to make cap space tier, is Mason Marchment from the Dallas Stars. And Dallas all of a sudden kind of shaping up to be
an interesting team to talk to if you're not just the Vancouver Canucks, but really anyone looking to bolster their forward group, because, as you said, they need to clear cap space. They have some significant work to be done. You know, they probably want to upgrade their blue line as well, although, as you said, maybe without breaking the bank to do so. And Marchment is one who's got 1 year left on a $4.5 million cap hit. And I think the thing with Marchment is, again, if we're talking about bringing in three or four different players, you're not checking the size and skill and speed boxes with all of the players. So if you bring in a smaller player like Marco Rossi, can Mason Marchment, who, of course, 6'5", experienced playoff guy, can he help you kind of balance the scales a little bit for how you're reshaping your forward group? And again, would the acquisition cost be relatively palatable because of the situation the Stars are in?
Yeah, the possibility that Rossi just will not sign with them and may look to the offer sheet route, which is going to be something that I think shapes a lot of these negotiations over the course of the next few weeks. You know, I do think to some extent we almost have to like operate in reverse in terms of how we think about teams' priorities as a result of what we consider to be this perfect storm offer sheet wise, right? The success of the St. Louis Blues being sort of line item one in a copycat league. The Blues have obviously sort of fundamentally breathed life into their retooling project as a result of their success with the Holloway-Broberg double offer sheet, super aggressive from Doug Armstrong last summer. That, I'm sure, has opened eyes across the league. In fact, I know it has, based on a variety of conversations I've had with NHL executives this season. Add in the growing cap, the cap growth that we're about to experience, and then add in, for good measure, sort of the lean options in unrestricted free agency and the idea that teams could actually prefer the RFA pool as a means of going about improving their roster. And you have, you know, a pretty favorable climate for teams to conduct their business a little bit differently this year. And I think as part of that, right, you've got, you know, these sort of you've got these players, whether it's J.J. Paterka, whether it's Marco Rossi, maybe Matthew Nyes, where their leverage over the course of the next 4 weeks leading up to July 1st is going to be totally different than it ever has been, because the moment the market opens, they're free to see what the market will bear. And for the first time in a long time, they might actually have suitors, right? This might not just be hypothetical. There may actually be offer sheets coming. And so teams have to sort of proceed backwards. In the past, it's been like, take care of your unrestricted free agent business, and the RFAs will fall into place, and you can grind them all summer, and on. There's sort of a gentleman's agreement, some might call it collusion, among NHL teams not to use this device very frequently, and as such, you know, you're restraining player salaries. And look, maybe that does still come to bear. I'm sure there's a lot of owners that are hoping it will, given how much the cap's poised to grow over the next few seasons. But, you know, if teams are in a purely competitive stance, we're going to see offer sheets. They are going to make sense for some teams, especially given the talent available. And so for players that, like, and I think Rossi's case is a little different. He went down to fourth line minutes in the playoffs. They clearly left a sour taste in his mouth. He's been very public about it. Paterka hasn't been as public about his displeasure with Buffalo, but it's pretty well known in the industry that he would welcome a change of scenery there. Frank Saravalli alluded to it recently in his Daily Faceoff trade board. Now, I don't have any sense that Nyes feels similarly, but, you know, we'll see how those talks proceed here. But, you know, it does change the way that teams have to prioritize and think about these things. And I do think that could cause some doors to open. Now, I still don't think the Canucks are going to heavily pursue the offer sheet route, but what it could do is change, as part of teams' internal calculations, the way they look to mitigate risk and the types of returns they're willing to accept on these players, especially with a ticking clock counting down to July 1.
I do just want to mention on the trade topic conversation a note from our colleague out in Toronto, Nick Kyprios, who of course hosts the Real Kipper and Bourne show and also writes for Sportsnet.ca, and he's published his off-season trade board 1.0, and now I don't know if it's like numbered in terms of likelihood to be traded or anything like that, but
the first player that on the list, the first player he writes about is Canucks center Elias Pettersson. Now, not any really intelligence in there in terms of which way the Canucks are leaning or what they might be thinking, but I think the most interesting line on Elias Pettersson from Nick Kypreos is, despite a down season for Pettersson, his value hasn't taken as big of a hit as many perceive, which is a key part, I think, of any conversation around Elias Pettersson and what the Canucks might do. I know that's something you've made the point quite a few times, right? That, and I just think back, how many games did he play post-JT Miller trade? Like 20?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause then he was injured, right? And we know that Carolina was ready to make a pretty significant offer for Elias Pettersson at that same moment. So if his value was X before the JT Miller trade, there's only, like, he didn't play enough games to significantly harm it after that. You know what I mean?
Because teams are going to be chasing. I mean, we're what's the conversation we're having? We're having the conversation.
Where can
about
you find the upside?
Where can you find the premium center? And by the way, just like the success of Broberg and Holloway in St. Louis might change how teams regard the possibility of leveraging offer sheets to improve their roster, you know, I think if teams are being honest with themselves anyway, like the success of the Florida Panthers and specifically Bennett and Reinhart, who were heavily distressed assets relative to the way they're regarded now when the Panthers acquired them, like, I think is going to be a reminder to teams that, hey, you got to swing the bat.
Yeah.
By the way, Patrick Laine in Montreal, right? He really punched up that power play significantly. They made the playoffs after making that trade.
I think the ultimate parallel, if you're trying to sell yourself on a Pettersson trade, is Eichel. That's it.
How about Pierre-Luc Dubois? I mean, there's a lot of parallels
here.
That's
an interesting one, too, actually, yeah.
You know, so it's like there's all around the league we see the bounce. Put it this way. If Pettersson played in another market as poorly as he played this year, we'd be talking about him as the can't-miss opportunity for the Canucks, given their needs. And so that's something to bear in mind here where it pertains to his trade value, is like someone's going to be willing to swing that bat and probably pay, you know, not fair market price for what we think he can be, but certainly fair market price for what he's been across the last season in order to do so if the Canucks decide to go in that direction.
Yeah. And
by the way, if they don't, I think it's vital that this organization starts to have his back publicly.
Which I think you could argue we started to see with Adam Foote's introductory press conference.
Yeah.
Like, and we talked about it at the time. At the very least, a different tone. Now, what's interesting is I think people also tried to...
It needs to be more than that, though.
No, like, because I agree, because people
they
tried...
They need to defend him.
People looked at what Jim Rutherford said with Satin Reach later that day and kind of tried to lump it in, and I actually disagree with that. I think what Rutherford's comments were not necessarily a change of tone. They weren't that publicly supportive of him in the same way that Foots was, right? So I think part of it is you need a party line on it, and everyone needs to stick to the party line. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you're going to speak on it, well, make sure you're falling in line and saying the same thing.
And that party line, and, you know, and look, partly it's on him, but to come back and have sort of put some of the questions to rest in terms of the summer that he had.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you don't hear, like, there's a reverence with which most teams' best players are discussed by that organization, and a defensiveness if those players are taking a lot of criticism. Think about Travis Green with Brady Tkachuk earlier this year, or, Brad Treliving with Austin Matthews, you know, just a couple weeks ago. Canucks have to get back to that, and the player needs to trust that the Canucks will have his back, just as much as the team has to trust that the player will live up to, you know, their side of the bargain.
Can I flip this around, though, and suggest that, and I'm partly playing devil's advocate here, if there's an unwillingness or if it's, like, trying in any way to do that, to have your play, the Elias Pettersson's back like that, at the same way someone would for Brady Tkachuk or Austin Matthews, like, does that not point towards the there's too much scar tissue built up here and they need to part ways? You know what I mean? Like, if it's because I can understand, you're like, okay, I understand. If you're in a management position, you understand intellectually, I need to rep my player. I need to have his back. I need to be an advocate for him. But I can also understand if you've been through some really frustrating things behind the scenes, how it can be very difficult to do that.
For sure. But then if you're not able to get to that place, then you've actually already made your decision about the direction that the franchise needs to go.
Yes, that's what I say. Yeah. That's what kind of my point is. Like, if you're not able to do that, and you're not excited about doing that,
that's why you're like you're playing. You're
that
like,
kind of answers the question for you.
Yeah, you're like well, I'm going to play devil's advocate. I'm like, no, I fully agree with what you just said, and I don't think our 2 points are incompatible at all.
It's like if you're in a marriage and you're having to like get up and do daily mantras about how you're going to be like nice to each other every day. It's like you should just get divorced. You know what I mean? Like why are you putting yourselves through that? Just don't go be happy somewhere else, right? And if it's like if you're like okay, we all have to be really nice about Elias Pettersson.
You're like the Reddit relationships advice page. You ever go to the Reddit relationships
advice? And they're all
advice?
Just like get divorced.
Yeah, the moment someone's like, yeah, my husband leaves too much of his beard shavings in the sink. It's like you should get divorced. Red flag. Like it's so easy.
He doesn't respect you.
Yeah, it's so easy to tell other people to end their relationship. It's incredible. That's what I learned from the internet.
And someone else just said, haha, not that simple, Jamie.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. Like if you have to psych
that beautiful life you've built.
No.
Throw it away.
But if you have to like psych yourself up to staying in the partnership, it's like, well, that's evidence that you shouldn't be in the partnership.
Okay, I'm just saying your Reddit our relationships advice over here.
Oh my goodness. Anyways. All right, I wanted to pass that note along from Nick Kiprios that Patterson's value maybe hasn't taken as much of a hit as you'd think given how poor his performance was this season.
No surprise. Yeah. I think that's no surprise.
Yeah, I think it makes sense considering the market and considering the highs he's hit in his career.
Yeah.
Some of the I want to get back to your trade target piece. I mean, We can always talk more Pettersson, but I feel like we don't have to shoehorn it in. You know what I mean?
No,
there will always be another opportunity
I just
to talk about
to do,
Elias Pettersson.
I just wanted to do the update on that. I think it's vital that this organization change tack and really vociferously have his back going forward. I think it's vital if they're going to repair this sort of relationship, as it were. Not that the relationship itself is damaged or that he wants out or anything, but I just think in terms of getting the best out of him.
I think
he needs to feel supported.
There's got to be some damage to the relationship. How could there not be?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know to what degree or that anyone wants out.
Sure.
But, like, it's got to be at least
complicated.
Put under strain
yeah.
by the last 15 months or so.
Oh, they updated their status to it's complicated on Facebook.
Right. That's right.
Get divorced. He doesn't respect you. Our relationship's advice.
That'd be a great job as a marriage counselor. They're just like, come in first session. You're like, guys, I got to be honest. I think you should get divorced. Another happy couple at the door. Back to your list of potential Canucks trade targets.
I think the problem with that is your billing cycle wouldn't be
long. Well, it's true. You need to constantly.
It's a bad business plan.
You need to like also be a divorce attorney or something
or
at the same time.
Or you need kickbacks from a firm. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You need to be giving out campaign or firm literature in the waiting room.
I'm going to funnel unhappy married couples to you. And then you pay me a kickback.
A little cottage industry.
Why hasn't anyone thought of this?
Mostly because I think people don't wish for other people's misery, Jamie.
Anyways, another name on your list, and I was talking about Mason Marchment from the Dallas Stars, and I do think Dallas is a kind of a fascinating team. I mean, we're hearing Jason Robertson's name out there.
Matt Duchene.
Mason Marchment, Matt Duchene. Yeah.
Who's become the patron saint of Canucks stock across the last couple of weeks.
Of you, at least. I'm not, I don't know. I'm having trouble getting there with the Matt Duchene conversation.
Fair enough.
But Maverick Bourque, and that one's one we've talked about a little bit as well.
Sure.
Young center with some upside.
Right-handed.
The detail I enjoyed in yours is your analysis of the situation was the potential of getting Maverick Bourque and also taking a bad salary, quote-unquote bad salary, inefficient contract back from Dallas. And you look at their blue line and you've got Ilya Lyubushkin at 2 more years at just over three. Matt Dumba, another year over $3 million.
But Dumba would be the one.
Yeah.
Like, don't you know, even though Lyubushkin has term on it, on his deal, and Dumba doesn't, Dumba, like, didn't play in the playoffs.
Yes.
Alex Petrovich was playing ahead of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that tells you everything, I think. Like,
yeah.
if Petrovich, a guy who they waived at the end of their
run. Could be in the lineup tonight for the Texas Stars.
Could be in the lineup tonight for the Texas Stars. You know, if that guy's playing ahead of Dumba, and I say that guy. I worked with Alex Petrovich in Florida, and he's a great kid. And I'm glad to see that he's stuck around and given himself new life in his NHL career because I thought he played really, really well for the Stars, who helped them stabilize what was a clear Achilles heel, and I'd imagine gets a one-way NHL deal out of it this summer. So I didn't mean to disparage him. I actually
have
a ton of admiration for what he's been able to hang on and accomplish here. But, yeah, I mean, you know, you solve our problem here, we'll pay to solve that issue. We see those trades all the time. We saw it with that's how the Carolina Hurricanes landed Seth Jarvis.
Yeah.
With the Patrick Marleau trade. So I think that's an interesting team building strategy, and I do think we're like, here's the other side of this, right? Because there's a whole tier of guys that I list, Ross Colton with the Colorado Avalanche, and you know, Maverick Bourque, I sort of lumped into it. Mason Marchman, I lumped into that too. You know, the Vegas Golden Knights are being linked to Mitch Marner.
Yeah.
Like, guess what they're going to have to do if they're going to be linked to Mitch Marner? Like, they're going to have to part ways with somebody who makes money in order to set that up. And so this is another part of the, like, the law of unintended consequences. Like, we think about this new cap growth era is allowing teams the space to, you know, pursue trades more easily or sign free agents. But the other thing it could do is set up the absolute best teams that are spending to the cap every year to trade useful pieces in order to continue to take those huge swings, right? Like, we want to chase Alex Pietrangelo, we're going to trade Nate Schmidt. Is like a classic Vegas Golden Knights example. So the Canucks have been on the receiving end of these deals in the past. That one didn't work. But
Nate Schmidt playing in the Stanley Cup final. It wasn't a bad idea. It just did not work out at all.
No, it didn't work here, and then that contract ended up getting bought out. So I would say Vegas was wise to sub in Pietrangelo, and they won a cup. So honestly, the JT Miller acquisition is a version of this too with the Tampa Bay Lightning. So, you know, as much as direct acquisition will be facilitated by cap growth, you're also going to see, I think, a world where more players have more value and we see somewhat more movement in that middle tier, in part because the teams that are contending are going to want to reset the books somewhat more aggressively in order to pursue the top talent in the game, especially because the top talent is so laser focused on going to winning situations.
Yes. Yeah. That is an interesting domino effect of, you know, okay, hey, we're not a destination for free agents. And you go down the list of the teams that are, and guess what? Most of them are capped out, or a lot of them are capped out, right? Florida, Tampa Bay, Dallas, et cetera. It's like, well, they got to do something. Those guys aren't – the top players also aren't going to take massive, massive discounts, tax situation notwithstanding, right? Maybe a little bit of a discount, but it's not nothing. So they're going to have to do something to clear up that cap space. I did think a fascinating deal handed out by the Tampa Bay Lightning to Yanni Gourde today, six-year deal at $2.33 million. He was going to be an unrestricted free agent, of course, traded back to Tampa at the deadline from Seattle. And I mean, Yanni Gourde, I believe, turns 34 in December, so a six-year deal for him. I mean, that's exceptional work by Yanni Gourde. I just think that, to me, that's like, we're going to see contracts that are new and surprising in all sorts of different ways. And this one isn't because of the AAV, but it is because of the term. And it's just, well, especially if you're a contending or cap-strapped team, you are going to have to think about every possible lever you have or card you have to play to get around this kind of cap explosion. And like, this is the number one example to me of, okay, we got to do something uncomfortable, and it can't be the AAV, so I guess it's got to be term here.
Yeah, and I think, like, for example, Pugh Suter, like, would you consider Pugh Suter and Yanni Gourde to be rough comparables this summer?
Yeah, that's not bad,
right?
Yeah.
And so if Pugh Suter signed on July 1 a contract with somebody for 4 years at $3.5 million, would you even bat an eyelash?
No.
Same total value.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, this is the classic third-line center deal, $3.5 million per year, that we'd usually give you for four, but let's stretch it out over six to keep the cap hit low given our overall circumstance.
Yeah.
That's what this is. Like, that's the language of this contract.
Yeah.
I'm not reporting anything. I haven't talked to anyone on either side of the deal, to be clear, but that's how I read it. As effectively, this is a market value third line center contract. It's just stretched out.
Yeah, it's 4 years of value stretched out to six.
Yeah.
And usually, like, a guy in Pugh Suter's position might not be willing to do that because he's hoping to hit free agency again at 33, for example. But for Yanni Gourde, it's like, well, I don't know what my prospects would be looking like at 37, so I'm willing to do the six-year deal.
And draw that money in a no-tax state and play for an organization that I trust, having been to a struggling organization and seen how the other side lives and decided that really what I want is to, you know, be here.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's effectively what's happened in it, and it's been very clear from the moment he showed back up in Tampa, right, that he viewed that as going home in a material way. So, yeah, I mean, you're seeing the Coronado-type big swing second contract. You're seeing the stretched-out veteran contract to sort of manage the cap hit. And I think that's an instructive, like, the real lesson of the Gord one, I think, is the same thing that I'm talking about, where just because the cap goes up doesn't mean that the best teams in the league aren't still going to be looking to shed talent in order to clear up additional flexibility, just like teams aren't going to fear term or additional term as a way to keep cap hits low on veteran players, right? Like, all of the same things that we became used to in the flat cap era are still going to happen and still going to exist, and teams are still going to function with some of those rules applying or front of mind. They're just going to do it on a grander, larger scale with sort of greater stakes and a level of priority that's somewhat tweaked.
Absolutely. All right. That is Canucks Talk for today. Again, we were out here on location at the University Golf Club for the Vancouver Canucks Alumni Charity Classic in support of the Boys and Girls Club of South Coast BC and the Canucks
Great
Alumni
event.
Scholarship. And
looks awesome. What a beautiful
People are having
too.
A blast. I'll tell you that.
So much fun.
There's a cigar tent. There's all sorts of fun
Heck
things
yeah.
going on here
Matt,
at
Matt
the course.
Cook mad at himself over a minus one.
Well, to be fair, I think it's best ball, and so I do get it. I get it. And we're like competitive athletes, it's like, minus one through nine or whatever they were playing
fair enough.
Best ball. I get being a little disappointed with that. But, yeah, fantastic. Shout out to Matt Cook for joining us here on location as
awesome.
Well. Remember, Abbotsford Canucks, game three tonight here on the station. Starts at 5. Brandon Astell on the call. They look to take a 3-0 series lead in the Western Conference Final. We'll be back on the air tomorrow for more Canucks Talk. Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.